Hello, everyone. Hi. Okay, fine. I'll do it the right way.
Thank you.
Hello. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome to our lovely little podcast.
Mm-hmm. So every 2 weeks, your hosts, me and you.
That's me.
That's her. Watch a movie. We do some homework. And we create Check Your Threading, which is a podcast that serves up history, psychology, theory, and perspective on the film.
Hooray.
So my name is Bonnie. I was a couple of minutes ago drinking water out of a glass covered in seagulls dressed as sailors. That was pretty cute.
I love that. My name is Lauren, and I like popsicles so much that sometimes I have to buy them in bulk. I would rather do that again. My name is Lauren, and I recently had an argument with my coworkers about the nomenclature behind ice pops versus otter pops, and I would like our listeners to weigh in.
Yes, indeed.
What movie are we watching this episode?
1997.
Is that a movie?
No.
It was a great year for pop music for 13-year-old Lauren.
That's true. Me too.
Yeah. 1997. We've spent some time in the late 90s.
We have.
But this is a different kind of time.
Yeah, it is. So we're watching Nowhere this week.
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Fucking Nowhere. What's that from, Lauren?
Boondock Saints, maybe, but mostly just from us saying it all the time.
It's like multiple year thing, but it's definitely from Boondock Saints.
Okay, thank you.
Nowhere is a 1997 comedy sci-fi drama written and directed by Greg Araki, and it stars James Duvall, Rachel True, and Nathan Bexton. Other cameos, they include Ryan Felipe, Heather Graham, Rose McGowan, and a tiny Mina Suvari. So like super 90s.
Basically. All huge names in the 90s, yeah. I also definitely just had a moment when you said sci-fi of like, really? But like, yeah, there's a huge part of this movie that's sci-fi. It's just the whole movie is so bizarre that somehow that became subsumed in my mind.
Yeah. So IMDb says Nowhere follows a day in the lives of a group of Los Angeles high school students and the strange lives they lead. And I'm just like, I guess.
Technically true.
I always love IMDb headlines because they're like the most basic version of movies. What was it? 300 is like soldiers go off to war or something.
Right.
Okay.
This is how Breaking Bad ends up in the TV shows about friendship category. And that, yeah.
Is that real?
Yeah. I have a screen cap of it on my desktop that I refuse to delete.
You should put it up in our Instagram.
I will. It's a prized possession.
Yes. Yes. So this movie was originally written as a pilot for a television show. Hmm. And that was back in the 90s. I think it was supposed to be on MTV, but I just don't think that the world was ready for Araki at that point.
Fair.
So a little personal history about me that I think is worth mentioning in our history section. I am absolutely enamored with the apocalyptic teen movie trilogy. Just it like, it's so important to who I was as an adolescent. So I don't know how my cousin and I got a copy of Nowhere in the 90s because we lived in like a highly conservative litter box in the panhandle of Texas, but we did. And we watched Doom Generation and Nowhere on the same night, and it changed my freaking life. No joke. Like, I don't think there's a bigger influence on my overall body of work than Greg Araki. I loved his style. I loved everything about his films in my teens, and that has continued on through into adulthood with all of his newer stuff as well. So I'm probably going to gush a lot. I just want to throw that out there in this episode.
Okay, fair disclaimer.
I can't really see myself having the ability to like remove myself from my love.
That's why this is not a review podcast. This is a cultural context podcast.
There we go. That's my cultural context. Yeah. So I also think it's important to say that I watched Nowhere, and then the next year or the same year, I can't really remember, I watched Velvet Goldmine. So there was a lot happening for me during that time as far as like learning about narrative and the first the first dick I ever saw was Ewan McGregor's.
Okay.
And glitter and flopping around joyously.
Wait, so, is there no full frontal in Nowhere?
I don't think so.
That's kind of amazing.
And if there is, right, probably cut it out because there's that whole 10 minutes missing from the film.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, so fair warning to anybody who tries to watch this. There's no version available in America. It never came to DVD or Blu-ray in the US. It's like only available in France or the UK or something like that for an obscene amount of money. So one day we'll get our unedited cut.
I hope so.
So personal history to contextual history, I would like to talk about the rise of teen TV for some context. So let me take you back to after the war.
Which one?
You know, the war, capital W, the big one, the big one 2.0. World War II. After World War II, basically we had all these feel-good, like, gleaming sitcoms like Leave It to Beaver, Dick Van Dyke, Andy Griffith, stuff like that. And it was all very feel-good, sitcom-y, problem-solving type stuff.
Hmm.
And even when we get into the 60s and 70s and we start to see The Brady Bunch and Different Strokes and Welcome Back, Kotter, which addressed social issues, it was still extremely upbeat and like everything would get tied up in a bow at the end of the day. So by the time we got to the late 80s, we were just teeming with desire for an angsty outlet. And along comes 90210 in 1990, which is an hour-long drama instead of a 30-minute sitcom. And it totally rewrote the book on teenage narratives. Talked about sex, talked about drugs, teen pregnancy, race, discrimination, and everything in between. And I'm not saying it did this well. They explicitly said that they were modeling their structure after soap operas, but this is the first time this stuff is showing up on primetime TV with a huge marketing budget, and Fox suddenly has like a breakout hit that it has to lean into hard. Some people think that Fox might have actually like folded as a network if not for 90210. So okay. Thanks, okay. I guess. So then, of course, every other network has to follow suit, and suddenly the whole primetime slot is like swallowed up by teen drama pretty much for the rest of time. This was magnified by the fledgling birth of the internet, and personal email addresses and fan sites so that like teenagers could talk about their thoughts about this stuff privately, teenagers and probably older people too. And then, so then we have My So-Called Life in 1994 with Party of Five, and then Buffy the Vampire Slayer a few years later. So you're with me on this. The period between 1990 and 1997, huge for teen angst TV shows. It's also a pretty idyllic period of time in the US. Our economy was growing. Gen X teens were a fresh, shiny new pool of money to tap. The internet is happening. We're pre-Columbine. We're pre-Clinton impeachment. We're obviously pre-9/11. It was kind of considered acceptable, even like expected, that you spend a couple of hours a week watching the misfortunes of other people,
right,
which is a little different from where we are now. So I feel like that's worth pointing out. So I'm thinking about that as a framework for Nowhere, coming out in 1997 and sort of flicking us in the nose for being so frothily rabid about all these teenage narratives. So obviously we have this bus stop scene that has these stars from 90210, from Charmed. And especially in that scene, they're using what's called high-rise terminal, but it's also throughout the entire movie. So high-rise terminal is Valley speak, it's upspeak, it's what we consider the Valley girl intonation that we use when we like want to make fun of people from California. But it's also part of how we talk now. I'm doing it right now. So it was popularized in the 80s, but definitely reinforced in the 90s by these teen shows that I've been talking about and by movies like Clueless, for example, which was like a gigantic hit. The use in Nowhere is interesting because linguists now in 2019 have pretty much all convened on the point of high-rise terminal and other modes of speech being considered feminine or belonging to the queer community and generally discriminated against because they're considered feminine. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is language that belongs to non-dominant groups. Mm-hmm. So for Araki to use this in the film, it feels to me like he's basically trying to create one more way that people won't respect what's happening, one more way to demonstrate that these are people who are traditionally dismissed. And then the other thing that I think is cool is that the entire point of uptalk is to achieve something called floor holding, which is the vocal indicator that I'm not done talking. Oh. So please don't interrupt me. And if you translate that into a film, it's trying to create a structure where the viewer doesn't interrupt their viewing experience. Hmm. But I feel like that's worth paying attention to.
Yeah, yeah. So just so I completely understand, high-rise terminal is Valley speak, and Valley speak is for the marginalized.
I think that it's a broad umbrella of the marginalized, because we are talking about literally all female or female-presenting people. We are talking about a huge portion of the queer community. We're talking about like large swaths of people. So I hesitate to say that it truly belongs to a very small margin, mm-hmm. but I do think that it is something that is weaponized against marginalized genders, the queer community, and other groups of people by cis hetero men who feel like you should only talk one way, you should only communicate one way. And it's been very effectively weaponized for a long time until linguists in the past couple of years have started writing essays and started speaking out and started talking about how obvious it is that there are benefits to high-rise terminal. And I could get into a whole thing here. I have a lot of feelings about high-rise terminal. Like, for example, it's indicated that women who use it or non cisgender men who use it are very demonstrable in their compassion. Like the high-rise terminal is used as a way to like emotionally connect with others. Mm-hmm. And the lack of it is a way to stop emotional connection, which I think is really interesting. Cisgender men view it as being deferential, and marginalized communities view it as, I'm not going to make an aggressive statement. I'm going to make room for you to share a dissenting opinion with me in this conversation.
Yeah, it's being inclusive.
Yeah. So when I say, this is how I feel, you know, mm-hmm. there's room for you to say, actually, I don't feel that way. Here's how I feel, you know? So there's more breadth in that conversation. Isn't that fascinating?
So cool. Language is so cool. Oh my God.
So anyway.
I had this like conversation that was not very pretty with this guy I went to college with about language and English and grammar being a living thing and not being like stagnant and with these intense rules. When you go by English dictionary, grammar, spelling, you are leaving out this whole interesting breadth of vernacular that other people have and experience. And it's like a part of our culture, you know, like it wasn't a pretty conversation. People who go by this, like, there's only one way to say something and this is the way you need to say it and spell it. There's an undercurrent of class privilege and racism in a way that goes on in there. Like,
I'm willing to be the person who's extreme enough to say that I think that it's fascism. And I'm a little embarrassed for saying that. Like, I'm not sure that I can really back that up, but it feels so much to me like this belief that if we can control the way people speak or write, then we can control their minds.
Yeah.
And I just don't believe that there's room for that in a world that creates poetry and art and language is a living, breathing organism.
Which I love. I love that idea of floor holding and like, especially considering like, Araki is a staple to the new queer cinema movement. Mm-hmm. He's an American filmmaker. And he, like, having that ability to, the idea of holding the floor for new queer cinema is such an interesting idea for that moment in time. You know,
I completely agree. I'm curious. Does he consider himself a queer cinema filmmaker before he considers himself an Asian American filmmaker?
I have no idea. Like, okay. I think he tries to defy all. You can't put him in a box. He doesn't want to be put in a box.
Okay.
So just a little background on Nowhere. It's the final chapter in Araki's teen apocalypse trilogy, which is a genre all to itself, in my opinion. It's delightfully postmodern, satirical, and it's like queer as fuck. So His style actually earned him the reputation of the bad boy of new queer cinema. But once again, like we were just talking about, he does not like to be called that.
Okay.
He doesn't want you to corral him into that identity or into some kind of political agenda.
Okay.
He prefers to just do his thing, you know, whatever that may look like.
Yeah, whatever that may look like, indeed.
So in an interview with Araki in Senses of Cinema, which I will link to in our blog, the authors Damon Young and Gilbert Kaluuya hypothesize that this actually may be because his work has continually challenged the heteronormative premises of conventional narrative structure.
Okay.
And it often discusses the difficulty of finding intimacy in a hyper-real world. So let's take a moment to discuss heteronormative narrative structure.
My favorite thing.
The four basic elements are the gender binary, patriarchal gender roles, monogamy, and white supremacy.
Okay.
I just wanted to kind of break down what heteronormative means because I think it's important to the overall plot and structure of Nowhere.
Yeah, so if we're going to say that he's subverting these ideas, we need to know what they are.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Okay.
So Nowhere is a film like Priscilla that is completely contemporary.
Okay.
But unlike Priscilla, it's completely American.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So Araki's films really capture a time and a place. So that would be, you know, United States, Los Angeles, California, 1997, you know, and it is wholly set on that stage. From the music, the clothes, the dialogue, the sets, literally everything about his film take place on that stage.
And it's going to live there forever.
Yes.
Yeah, this felt like it was almost like a, like when they were introducing all the characters at the beginning, it felt like a counterculture bingo. But counterculture specifically for 1997. Like, okay, there's the film school nerd, and there's the like rough and tumble lesbian and weird green haired drug addict guy, like BDSM piercing weirdo, like
that's
bingo.
So true. Oh my gosh, yes, yes. So I was just about to say that. So
okay.
Stereotypes, and they're coming out sideways, and not only of counterculture, but of, you know, the cultural norms, like the sweet, naive young girl, the hopeless romantic, the valley girls. Yet their dimensions come out. Like as a teenager in that time, such as you and I, we identified with those people on some level, and you start to become like apprehensive of what's going to happen to them, you know?
Sure, yeah.
Especially movies in that time, they did not always end with a neat little bow like sitcoms, you know?
No.
They were very, like, I don't know if the main character is going to live. I don't know if any of these side characters are going to live and how terrible their deaths might happen to be, you know?
Yeah, if you were even remotely out of the mainstream movies, like if you were on the second shelf at Blockbuster, everybody was fair game. And I definitely felt like a certain amount of dread when I was watching this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and again, part of that is because once again, like the millennium is approaching, just like in Armageddon, we're, you know, thinking about what is going to happen to us, right? So I actually was reading something about his most recent production. I think it's on Stars and it's called Now Apocalypse. So it's his actual television show that was out in March, I believe.
Okay.
And the article is Exploring Queer Millennial Angst of Greg Araki. And the author is Claire Marie Healy. And she says, even now, there is nobody who understands the brutality of adolescence better. Completely agree with that statement.
That's intense.
Right? And it's true. Like, he really knows how to present adolescence, not from an adult point of view, but literally like you are there with them. Like, the person behind that camera, to me, is a character in the film. You know?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
The other thing about the anxiety and the end times and such is for me, the gay community was already feeling this for a while, this doom. It wasn't because of the year 2000 coming. It's like there was a plague, a literal plague. And like suddenly all these young people are growing up in a world where it's so scary to like be close to each other.
Yeah, I mean, the gay community didn't know that they were out of it in 97. They didn't, like, it's only with the power of retrospect that we could see that the bell curve was trending down. Like, yeah. In 97, you're still just like, what the fuck? Like,
right.
Okay, so we're talking about it now on MTV. We're talking about the fact that we should use condoms. But, like, we're not talking about it in high school health class. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about it at church. We're not talking about it with our parents.
Yeah.
So I definitely see what you're saying. Like, the queer community is definitely still growing in an environment of fear in 1997.
Yeah, yeah. Again, that fear of intimacy, like getting close to people is hard. And, you know, in the film, everyone says, I love you at least once. And then the person they're saying it to, no one can say it back. Like, huh. It's either ditto or me too, or, you know, like, you're so cute, I heard a couple times. Oh, wow.
Okay, yeah.
Up until the end when Dark, who's the main character, and Montgomery, his, like, you know, love interest, are sitting there, and Montgomery says, I love you, and then Dark self-corrects, because I think he said me too, and then he self-corrected to say, I love you too.
Okay.
Because, like, it really is about, like, that fear, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And, like, I believe that the hyper reality of the world that Araki created is actually a part of the hyper anxiety he's like accumulating in the film.
Okay. You know?
So I'm going to get a little heady here, okay?
Okay. I'm with you.
There's a French sociologist named Jean Baudrillard who coined the phrase hyper reality in his work. His work is Simulacra and Simulation. I'm going to link it in our blog.
Okay.
So hyperreality is an inability to distinguish reality from a simulation of reality, especially in technologically advanced worlds, like think Blade Runner, for instance. And hyperreality is seen as a condition in which what is real and what is fiction are blended together to the point that no one can tell where one ends and the other begins.
Okay.
So an early semiotic study found that today's consumer society, today being, I don't know when, I can't remember, but I'll put it in the blog, is basically a large network of signs and symbols that need to be decoded, right? So when you see big yellow arches, you aren't confused. You know exactly what you're looking at.
Right. We've created a visual language.
Yeah. So that furthered this idea that our current society has replaced all reality and meaning with symbols and signs, and that human experience is a simulation of reality, right?
Okay, gotcha.
So with Nowhere, I feel like Araki spent a lot of time creating his simulacra and simulation. And there are signs and symbols everywhere. Like, you see them on, you know, bus benches and walls. And I think one could argue that the real world in the teen apocalypse world is actually the teen angst, right? That's the real world where they live. And the simulation is like the no seeing Brady Bunch families, like, who surround the angsty teens. Like,
sure, yeah.
There's so much of that sitcom reality you're talking about where, like, mom and dad are eating TV dinners at the television and they're completely unaware of what's going on because these things that are happening to these young people are so real.
Right.
Like when Egg gets raped and she goes home and her parents are just like, hey, how's it going? They just don't know how to deal with it, you know?
Sure.
They don't understand. Right.
Yeah.
So I think that the simulated reality would actually be the reality that the adults are living in.
Sure. That's a really powerful message to send to a teenager who's basically feeling like they're stuck living in this simulated setting.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to reuse the word, but that's basically what it is.
Totally is. So question time?
Oh my gosh, it's question time.
It's question time.
So question time is when we ask each other questions that the other person hasn't had a chance to prepare for.
That's correct.
My first question for you is, if you could steal anyone's wardrobe in this movie, whose would it be? Only one, Bonnie. Only one person.
Dark's,
okay.
Dark is the main character.
Yeah, I know.
I really like his style. I'm telling them.
I'm sorry.
I like his style, and it's perfectly simple. and it's a little understated. I love
okay.
it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love that. All right.
It was hard to pick. What about this makes you uncomfortable? This movie made Lauren very uncomfortable.
It
so
did.
What about it makes you so uncomfortable?
Oh, you're going to make me think about it. Okay. So when we were watching this movie, I wrote down a couple of things. One, this movie reminds me vaguely of Twin Peaks just based on the soundtrack alone. The content did not end up panning out into that, but Twin Peaks makes me uncomfortable as a television show. Like, we were off to a bad start.
Not the bad way, though.
Not the bad way, no. And then the other part is that I feel like, so I spent the first half of the movie going like, oh my God, what's going on? Oh my God, like, how do I, it's like, it's changing. You're meeting like a cast of like 29 people or however many.
Yeah.
And they all have their own ridiculous, you know, personality quirks and stereotypes. And like I said, the bingo sheet. So I feel like every single member of this cast of characters is a trope that I was warned against in public school health class. But and I think that's part of what makes it like an unapologetically queer movie. Mm-hmm. Everybody's polyamorous, and the entire movie is just like no explanations necessary fucking.
Yeah.
And maybe that plays into like some of the negative LGBTQ community stereotypes, but I feel like it's more about being a teenager. Like you said, it's like the most instinctive thing for like teenagers to want to be intimate and be sexual, and they're doing that in fear.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's more a commentary on the teenage life than it is on the queer lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the sheer ratio of sex that's happening in this movie. But I think that was part of what made me so uncomfortable was like, okay, so there's this like insane stuff happening and then all of a sudden people are fucking. And then there's like, more crazy stuff happening and now there's an alien and there's a ray gun and then there's people fucking. And it's just like, that's not the kind of content that I'm used to. And I'm not opposed to any of it, but it usually there's only one or two of those things happening. At a time, not like 90 in sequence, and that's the entire film. So, and I don't mean any of this in a negative way.
No, of course not. No, I can tell.
It's just, you know, it was a very different viewing experience for me. And I can't imagine how I would have reacted to it if I'd watched it as a teenager, like, other than sitting very quietly in a dark room by myself and never telling anyone that I'd seen it.
I feel like that's based on experience.
Yeah, I definitely watched a lot of movies in a dark room by myself.
And didn't tell anybody about them.
Yeah, I mean, until the internet came along, it was like, I'm not going to breathe a soul about this. Anyone. Velvet Goldmine, perfect example.
I was going to say that for me.
Oh, man.
Okay.
So, key takeaways.
Yeah, I have two very okay. short ones.
Okay.
This movie is... It's drugs, it's sex, it's violence, it's postmodern, it's satirical, but like at its core, when I watch Nowhere, what I see is young people who want to love and be loved.
Okay, that's a good takeaway.
And going back to what I was saying about how Greg Araki has affected my body of work and like my mentality on creative process, I found a quote by him a while back that is very short and to the point, but I think it's very poignant, which is, it's just the idea to do your own thing. And some people get it and some people don't. And literally, like,
oh,
that's
God.
Every
single I'm one of the people who doesn't get it. No, I promise I get it. I don't want to be lame.
But that's literally, like, his entire body of work. And I feel like, you know, I went to school and I had a lot of people trying to tell me how to do something, quote, better.
Yes.
And I never did because I just felt like what I was doing was my own thing.
Yes.
And... Thank you, Lauren.
You're welcome, yeah.
And it's just, that's something that I feel like everybody should embrace if they can, is like, it's your own thing. Some people get it, some people won't, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, some people are Michael Bay and some people are Greg Araki, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I feel like that can be applied to Michael Bay too. Like, some people really get Michael Bay.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
So
fair enough. I was just thinking like big blockbuster hit people.
Yeah, yeah. No, I got you. Different strokes for different folks. And in Greg Araki's case, a lot of strokes. Are you winking? this is interesting because I feel like this is the first time that we've unintentionally had a very similar takeaway.
Uh-huh.
So my takeaway is that the idea of like, can satire have sincerity? And because I feel like the message is sincere, but the delivery is satire. And this might be the first time I've really experienced that. I feel like in a certain context, satire always has a message, but it's not always necessarily sincerity. Like when I think of like the importance of being earnest or something like that, the message in that play is not sincerity. So the idea that, you know, he almost has this like radical sincerity as his message is really, really fascinating to me.
Like in a way, at that time, disillusionment and apathy was such a part of the arts at that point that mm-hmm. it was almost radical to be sincere and to be compassionate and to like really open themselves up, you know?
Yeah.
It was not easy. It still isn't, but at that point in time, I feel like it was so much more difficult.
So what are we watching next week? Next time? I always say next week.
Eventually, we'll probably get there. Let's see. Next time, we will be going into July, which is the season of America.
Yes. No America. Other country has a day about themselves.
That's not probably. True.
No, it's true. America.
America the beautiful.
Huge part of the world because we mean the United States when we say America.
So okay. What we're watching next is a film called George Washington. Okay. Very excited.
All right.
Washington. 6 foot 20 fucking killing for fun.
Oh my God. Gotta link that now.
Early internet memes.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
So why don't you send us away?
I shall. Thank you all for listening. Don't forget to hit that follow button on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Stitcher to get notified when we release a new episode. You can also find all our contact information and an episode archive on checkyourthreading.com. And please follow us on Twitter at checkthreading or Instagram at checkyourthreading.
Boom.
We'll see you next time.